today. Are immigrants being unfairly blamed for problems around integration? And the final stretch in the Australian elections.
It was a hot Saturday evening and I was looking through the headlines on the Guardian website, like any loyal employee, and I saw this headline and it was about Tony Blair, and he'd made this intervention about integration and migrants. And I started to read the story and I felt myself getting increasingly annoyed. And then I went and followed it through to the report and I became really furious.
What had made Guardian columnist Aditya Chakraborty so angry came from a report from Blair's Institute for Global Change called The Glue That Binds Integration in a Time of Populism. It was the foreword, written by the former Prime Minister himself, that was particularly frustrating. It said the right to practice diversity should be preserved, but Blair stressed that immigrants had a duty to integrate, to accept the rules, laws and norms of our society. To Aditya,
there was no counterbalance where he said, you know, migrants shouldn't have to face racism. Racism is a bad thing. I don't like Tommy Robinson or any of the far right. There was none of that. And it made me think that yet again, there was a kind of sense from a big name, greyback politician of, well, migrants aren't causing racism, but I'm going to blame them anyway.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, isn't it time to stop blaming immigrants? I want to start with a warning that in this podcast, Aditya describes a racist incident from his childhood that includes offensive language.
While I was reading what Tony Blair had to say about migrants and their duties to fit into society, I thought about my mother's own experience.
When did your family immigrate to the UK and why?
They came in the 60s and they came separately. My father came because he was a law student in the early 60s and he came by ship from Calcutta, Italian ship that fed him nothing but pasta for 6 weeks and left him feeling rather sick of Italian food by the end. My mother, on the other hand, came by plane into Heathrow, cut above my father, you'll notice, a theme that was often explored in the household. And she came with the idea of being a postgraduate student in education and studied at the University of London. And they met here in North London through their student bedsit community of Bengali students in the late 60s, early 70s, in Swiss Cottage, in Belsize Park. Most of those people, most of those Bengalis actually went back to India after finishing their studies. My parents, on the other hand, met here. My father wooed my mother, and this all resulted in me and us talking today.
You've started, but tell me a bit more about your mum. What are your parents' names?
My mother's name is Arati. My father was Ashish.
So your mum became a teacher. Mm. What does she teach and where?
She was a primary school teacher in East London. And she taught, first of all, in an Orthodox Jewish school in Stamford Hill. And then moved down the road to Rushmore, where she taught for decades. And she was the kind of teacher, Nushka, that all the parents wanted their kids to go in her classroom. Because she was a bit tough, but she really got results. And the remarkable thing about this school, Rushmore, was at the time, nearly all the teachers in this school were from the former Commonwealth. So they were from the West Indies, they were from India, they were from Nigeria, and they were all women. And so you had this community of quite tough Black and Asian women who'd come through an English education system in their own home countries and had brought some of that knowledge to this inner London state primary.
And how does she talk about that time? Does she face discrimination?
One of bits of her experience gets turned into kind of family folklore in the way that these things do, is that she went for an interview at a school in inner London and she faced an all-white interview board and they said, well, you know, Mr. Chakraborty, your experience is really impressive, but we notice that you're wearing a sari. And how do you think you're going to be able to control a classroom of somewhat unruly children while wearing a sari? And my mother's retort was, well, my own mother swam the Ganges every day in a sari, and if she can manage that, I'm sure I can handle a classroom.
And she got the job?
No.
She didn't?
No.
So it's interesting because I was thinking about my own mum who came here in the 70s, and she was a GP, and she went for an interview and she got the job, but only because she agreed to come to work every day in English clothes.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah, they thought it would be off-putting for patients for her to be there in her sari or salwar kameez.
Right. I mean,
she doesn't care about that these days.
I think I take from both our mothers' experiences two big lessons. I know from my mother that she turned up in this country having read Palgrave's Golden Treasury. So she knew all about, you know, English romantic poetry. She knew Shakespeare. When she comes here, she's seen as a good migrant because she's highly skilled. She knows English. She knows English culture. You know, she's got it all down pat, right? But the thing that then stands out is the fact that she's wearing a sari. So to bring this back to Tony Blair for a second and this discourse about integration and fitting in, in a way, you couldn't have hoped for a migrant to fit in better than my mum did when she turned up in this country. And yet, even that's not enough. Even then, the peg still isn't quite square enough to fit into the hole, right? So she's asked the interview, well, why are you wearing a sari? Well, why shouldn't she wear a sari? I should say, by the by, the entire time that my mother taught at school, I remember her driving off every day in a sari. She would be tootling off in this small, crappy hatchback, and these kind of bullying van drivers who would be having a go at her for driving at the speed limit and not over it would roll down their windows and would shout things like, you know, "Packy, piss off back to where you come from." To a woman who was probably going off to teach, if not their kids, then maybe their friends' kids or their neighbours' kids, English and the rudiments of English culture, because it was a country that still was living under a very heavy shadow of racism. Just to remind you, my mother arrived in this country around the same time that Enoch Powell made his famous speech about the rivers of blood and about how migrants would never really fit into this country.
We must be mad, literally mad, as a nation to be permitting the annual inflow of some 50,000 dependents who are, for the most part, the material of the future growth of the immigrant-descended population. It is like watching a nation busily engaged in heaping up its own funeral pyre.
And as much after Enoch Powell as 1990, so when you're a teenager, Norman Tebbit did a famous thing, the infamous cricket test. And I ask you about this because I think it's something that really upset.
For our generation, it was really important.
Yeah, and it upset a lot of my parents and their friends. He basically said, this is a sign of whether you are really British or not.
Yeah.
If India's playing England or if Bangladesh is playing England, who do you support?
Yeah.
How did your family react to that?
Anushka, I don't really follow cricket, but I'm delighted to tell you that I always fail the cricket test because when India play England, I will always support the far superior team, which is obviously India. And in our household, that was always the case. The oddity about the Tebbit test is actually Tebbit grew up down the road from where I grew up.
You've talked about the discrimination that your mum faced. Did you face discrimination in school?
So this area in which I grew up, it had its fair share of the far right. So I think we would both have grown up in the time of the National Front. And one of my early memories as a kid is being chased home by skinheads shouting "Packy." I spent the first year at my mum's inner London primary school. After a certain point when she fell ill, I went to the primary school nearest my house. And the very first day I turned up at playtime, all the kids went out into the playground and were shouting "rubber lips, nigger lips," and making monkey noises at me. And at a certain point, I went to the teacher and asked if they would do something about this. Can you imagine how old I was, 6 or 7? And she simply shrugged. This went on for days and days.
So look, we've talked about kind of race in Britain through the 60s, 70s, 80s and into the 90s. Mm. We're talking about Tony Blair. In 1997, he became Prime Minister. Just as your mum is such a central part of our story, I must ask you how she felt about that.
My mother would always make me stay up with her and watch the election results come in. But on the evening of May the 1st, 1997, she actually said to me, I'm going to bed early because I really don't care who wins this.
Wow. Didn't have Dee Ream playing in the kitchen the next morning.
She certainly did not think that things could only get better. I should say she definitely engaged in politics and in working politics at that. But she spotted Blair from very early as being basically a charlatan who was going to sell them out.
Okay, so Arati's not very happy on the May evening in 1997.
My mum's a tough crowd, right? A one-woman tough crowd.
So let's just take us through what comes after this. So Tony Blair is elected. He becomes Prime Minister. At that time, the type of way that we talk about immigration is starting to change. In 2001, there's 9/11, and that's followed by a spike in anti-Muslim bigotry. Blair takes some tougher steps on immigration, but when Eastern European countries join the EU...
We're welcoming 10 new member states into the European Union. And today marks a new beginning.
He doesn't put in place transitional controls. Then some figures on the left change the tone. Commentator David Goodhart, for example, says diversity from mass migration has weakened social solidarity.
However, I also take issue with the account that sees us as a happily integrated, multiracial, multicultural society. I think we're much more separate in many of our big cities.
And David Cameron gives a speech in 2012 in which he says state multiculturalism has failed.
In the UK, some young men find it hard to identify with the traditional Islam practiced at home by their parents.
How did you feel about that?
It's fascinating, Anushka. When you were talking, I was thinking about all the figures you mentioned. David Cameron, David Goodhart, Tony Blair. What do they all have in common? They're all white men talking about the experience of black and minority ethnic people, right? The second thing, what they all doing, they're talking about the lived experience of migrants and children and grandchildren of migrants. Just to add a bit to what you say, to give you the kind of the view from below, as it were, to those kind of high political landmarks you're quite rightly pointing out. My memory of the 90s and noughties is basically one in which civil society, after a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth by front bench politicians, especially on the conservative side, actually civil society largely just got on with it. And the experience of lots of migrants and their children is basically that they were getting on with fitting in, and their children were getting on with kind of making the most of the opportunities available to them. But the other thing I would say is, in that time, immigration and how people thought about immigration changed two or three times over. So immigration was at first seen within our lifetimes as being about largely Asian and black people coming from the former Commonwealth to this country. And then at a certain point, it switches. Immigration no longer is about colour, because actually here all these people come from Eastern Europe and they're white. So no longer is your skin colour a definite tell as to whether you're from a migrant background or not. The other thing that happens, as you quite rightly say, is we had 9/11, and suddenly people who might have doubts about immigration are able to cover them up by talking about the problem of making Islam fit within Western culture. So Islamophobia then acts as a kind of a front, a kind of ideological front behind which people can start putting all the old doubts about migrants and whether they ever could really fit in. They could shunt that all on to Muslims. And those are the kind of the two big moves that happen within our lifetime. Now, you get to 2012, as you say.
Under the doctrine of state multiculturalism, we've encouraged different cultures to live separate lives apart from each other and apart from the mainstream.
David Cameron makes this big thing about multiculturalism and how effectively people should fit in, and we should stop drawing attention to the differences between us and start thinking about similarities.
So your mum should take off her sari.
Indeed, according to him. But the other thing that's happening within that decade, let's not forget, the key thing that has marked out this decade in the British experience is historic spending cuts.
Fairness is also about being fair to the person who leaves home every morning to go out to work and sees their neighbour still asleep living a life on benefits.
So yes, you do have a lot of people pitching up into the country from the rest of the EU. They tend to be young, of working age, and not infirm. They're coming to work. They're not coming to take benefits. They're actually paying more into the exchequer than they're taking out. What is David Cameron and his Chancellor George Osborne doing over the same period? They're making these spending cuts so that actually there is increased pressure on classrooms, on hospitals, on the benefit system. And effectively, they're letting migrants take the flak for that.
The lesson is, don't do what Labour did, which is let everybody in without any checks or balances or restrictions on benefits. We're going to have very tight checks on benefit claimants. We do not want benefit tourism.
So by the time we get to 2016 and the Brexit referendum, you can go to lots of places across Britain where people will point at their public services and say, well, my mum had to wait months for her hip replacement, or I go down to the A&E and it's an absolute hellhole and you have to wait hours to be seen.
This was the paediatric emergency department.
These nurses and doctors are working really hard, but there just ain't enough of them. There's people lined up in corridors on beds. There's people stood up all in here, there ain't even enough seats to sit down. It's absolutely appalling.
Or my kids go to a classroom and there's over 30 other children in the classroom with them.
And harsh spending cuts in the education sector in the UK have forced more than half of all schools to increase class sizes.
All true, but not necessarily the fault of immigrants, who are after all paying the taxes, which would have meant that those kind of pressure and resources would not need to be there. So what you have, I think, under the Conservatives and abetted by the Lib Dems, a political class quite happy to let migrants take the flak for an action that they're perpetrating, which is cutting public spending. So at the same time as the British political class needs migrants to come over here to wipe British bums in care homes, to tend to the sick in hospitals, to build bridges and railway lines, at the same time they're effectively allowing them to become targets for racists and people who may not have been racist but increasingly thinking that maybe the racists are onto something.
And you mentioned Eastern Europeans, because of course that's the kind of third wave, if you like, in our lifetimes, of a group that is seen as other, and that was perhaps scapegoated or caused concerns around the country, a lot of which arguably did lead up to Brexit.
At just gone 4:30 in the morning, we are calling it for Leave to win this referendum. An extraordinary
moment. I think Brexit's very important for various reasons. And one of them is that it sent people like Tony Blair into an absolute
tizzy.
Spin. Yeah, I mean, centrists across Britain are really struggling to cope with the idea that we may have to leave the European Union. And the reason I mention the 2004 accession of Eastern European countries and the decision by Tony Blair not to put controls on immigration from there, which other countries like Germany did do, is that arguably that may have added to people's concerns about immigration over the years. And so the report that has sent you into a tizzy that Tony Blair has brought out is essentially arguing for, if we were to reverse this vote, if we were to say we're not going to Brexit, what could we do to address some of the concerns that led to Brexit? And one of those is around combating far-right bigotry, as he puts it, but also around dealing with very genuine concerns about immigration. And within that, he suggests that we should have had more of a focus on integration.
Yes.
Isn't it fair to say that it would be good for society as a whole if there was not some of the more segregated communities that there have been in the past?
I find it really quite lowering to the spirits to be using the same jargon about the migrant experience in this country as my mother's generation were using 40 years ago. So we're still talking about integration, we're still talking about multiculturalism, we're still talking about assimilation. In that time, four decades of lived experience by people from the Commonwealth and from the European Union, they do not seem to have been accommodated within this debate at all. It's still other people talking about people like me and my experience and my mother's experience. The second thing to say is, people often talk about, they use this language of parallel lives and segregation. There's very little thought given to who is causing that kind of segregation. So it is quite often the case that when you'll get Asians or blacks moving into a neighbourhood, white people start to leave. There is white flight. It has been pointed out by academics. Similarly, when people talk about, well, there are Muslim women who don't learn English, actually, as Louise Casey pointed out just a couple of weeks ago, the form integrations are, I mean, the numbers there are vanishingly small. She herself says, you know, that there is not evidence of people crossing their arms saying, I don't want to learn English. What I do find, personally, I find is in the area in which I spent my childhood and early teenage years, there are loads of Eastern Europeans there now. Some of them are highly qualified. They can't now get the English language teaching that they might want because David Cameron cut the funding to all those things. So they can't integrate, as he would put it, in the way that he might demand because he's deprived them of the means of doing so.
Is anyone offering political leadership on this in your eyes?
One of my great disappointments about the Labour leadership of Jeremy Corbyn is there's a Labour politician who I thought for the first time in my experience of the Labour Party was not going to dog whistle, was not going to issue a mug, making some pledge about immigration, was not basically going to sell migrants out. And one of the things that I found genuinely most personally depressing is Labour keep flipping and flopping on issues like freedom of movement. And actually Corbyn, while he won't quite use the language of Gordon Brown and talk about British jobs and British workers, he comes pretty damn close.
Was it the foreword to the report written by Blair that you particularly objected to?
The Blair foreword to the report that's issued in his name, in the name of his think tank, the Blair foreword is particularly bad. The report that follows is only marginally better. Again, it's all written by white people about what BME people have to do to fit in. But there's barely any recognition there that actually things like white flight do happen, that actually racism still does happen, that actually employers will have outsourced workforces of Latin cleaners, of black security guards, and that they won't be giving them the full employment rights that they deserve. Part of what informs that is a sense of, racial discrimination. Let's not beat around the bush.
So I've read the report and clearly a lot of what you say does characterise the tone of it. But they do mention the rise of the far right and they don't mention racism, but they do say divisive rhetoric is fueling prejudice towards minorities. And they do talk about tackling myths, for example, around the fiscal contribution of immigrants. But are you being too black and white about it? I mean, I think Tony Blair would have encouraged your mum to go to work in a sari.
We're talking at a time in which major British politicians are castigating women of colour in this country precisely for the items of clothing that they choose to wear. So forget about my mother's sari for a moment. Do you remember Boris Johnson doing an entire column about how women in burqas look like walking postboxes? So actually, I would say to you, whatever an individual politician might or might not have said, we're still living in a time in which basically people of colour, of different cultures, of different ethnicities, still have to argue day by day for the right just to have a little bit of their culture with them. So I think any politician who willingly marches into this debate and is not mindful what the lived experience of BME people in this country is, well, they are selling those people short. And they're not doing their part as politicians to make a serious contribution to this argument. My issue is we need to move on from this idea that it's always a new entrant who has to do everything and make up for all the deficiencies and deal with the discrimination with a smile on their face. And it's never the people who are supposed to be welcome into this society who've got any responsibilities to bear.
That was columnist Aditya Chakraborty. You can read his column at theguardian.com. We asked the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change to respond to his criticism. They encouraged everyone to read the full report and sent the following statement. The report makes clear that the far right are major obstacles to integration and that tougher measures are needed for those who incite hatred. It is also explicit that an integration strategy must be about everybody and that the responsibility is for all citizens, not just those coming into a country. Coming up, Guardian Australia's political editor, Catherine Murphy, on Saturday's federal elections as Australians head to the polls to elect the country's next parliament
and Prime Minister. Now, as Australians prepare to head to the polls this weekend, Australia political editor Catherine Murphy looks at whether the country could be on the brink of a new government.
In many ways, this campaign has been a very traditional one, very traditional, old-fashioned even. Vote One, Labor Party for getting rid of tax breaks for wealthy people, for a big program of social spending, for a big progressive agenda. This could have been a Labor campaign in the mid-70s or the early 80s. It's way, way sort of back to basics in terms of a brand Labor campaign in Australia. Similarly for the Liberal Party, Scott Morrison has tried to make this election contest all about Bill Shorten and not much about the Liberal Party at all. Now, the Liberal leader has done that because Bill Shorten, the Australian Labor Party leader, is not very popular with voters. He's had trouble connecting. So Scott Morrison's kept a lot of focus on Bill Shorten and on Labor as risky, old-fashioned, tax and spend sort of socialist hoodlums. That's kind of been his whole narrative. But in terms of what the Liberal Party is offering Australians, because there is an agenda there, Scott Morrison hasn't spoken much about it for this campaign, but there certainly is an agenda there. It's about delivering personal income tax cuts across the scales, but particularly the big benefits go to people on the highest incomes. Morrison has also tried to tell Australians that you can give them a big whacking tax cut and still maintain the current level of spending on social services. Now, that doesn't quite add up, but it hasn't achieved or hasn't sort of attracted a lot of focus on this campaign or during this campaign because Scott Morrison has been very effective in saying, look at Bill Shorten, he's the risk.
Don't let Labor's higher taxes shorten Australia's future. Labor. The bill Australia can't afford.
Climate change has been a very significant issue in this federal campaign. It's been a big issue because there's been a protracted drought in Australia, which has raised consciousness on the part of Australian voters to the risks of climate change and how the risks of climate change impact the driest continent on Earth. So it's been a very galvanising issue. Labor has put it at the centre of its political campaigning. Bill Shorten has pointed out that there has been 10 years of the most appalling hyper-partisan politics on climate change in Australia, which has been entirely destructive to policy outcomes. He has basically made climate change synonymous with politics working or not working. Climate change in Australia is Australia's Brexit. It's the issue where hyper-partisanship trumps logic. So Bill Shorten has elevated climate change as an issue.
The contrast and the case for change is night and day, black and white. If you want to see real action on climate change, you need to vote for a Labor government.
Scott Morrison and the Liberals have countered Labor's argument on climate change in a couple of ways. The first offensive pushing back against Shorten's climate messaging was it costs too much. We've had weeks and weeks of Scott Morrison saying the cost of action is too high. Bill Shorten's leaned into the argument and he said, well, that's fine, Scott, but what about the costs of inaction? The Labor Party has been in front in all of the opinion polls for the last 3 years and in all of the opinion polls that we've seen prior to Election Day. They are in front, but the margin is very narrow. And we know from our field work at Guardian Australia during this campaign, we've been out and about in the electorates that will decide the outcome of our election on Saturday night, that people are feeling different things in different parts of the country. It looks at the moment like there will not be a uniform national swing one way or the other. And elections like that are very hard to call. Both of the major parties at the moment believe that the result on Saturday night will be close. There's a lot on the line in this election. It's more than about who is the Prime Minister on Saturday night. I think it will determine how election campaigns are conducted at the national level in Australia for many years to come.
do follow the coverage of the elections at theguardian.com. And you can listen to Catherine Murphy and the rest of the political team on Guardian Australia's Politics Live podcast. That's all for today. My thanks to Aditya Chakraborty and Catherine Murphy. Today's episode was produced by Mythili Rao, Miles Martignoni and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a lovely weekend and we'll see you on Monday.